So, good evening, and welcome back to those who are returning, and welcome to those who are joining for the first time, not just the first time this course, but the first time JLI students. So welcome and thank you for joining. I hope everybody had a nice weekend and Memorial Day, and the fact that you prioritizing being here tonight, even on a weekend off, means that you're a serious student of Judaism and Jewish medical ethics in particular. So there was this this guy was sitting on the couch watching television, and his wife was nearby, and she sat down on the couch, and the husband spoke up. He said, "Do you mind if we have a conversation relating to end-of-life matters?" And she said, "Okay." So he said, "I just want you to know that if I ever end up in a vegetative state, I just want you to pull the plug." So she stands up and pulls the plug out of the television. Wow. So, just a little disclaimer before we dive in. When talking about end-of-life related matters, there's, and especially specifically what we're going to be addressing tonight with how to go about making decisions, is obviously extremely heavy, sensitive matters. And we're actually going to address this point later on, but it's possible for there to be feelings of guilt from the past. And maybe as we discover the Jewish take on all of this, it may bring up such feelings. Maybe it may even create such feelings. Who knows? So I'm just—I just wanted to say at the outset that the good thing is that we're gathering to learn about the Jewish take, what Judaism says about all this, and it's not about the past, but about the future, and that we do the right thing going forward. So, in a way. In a way, we are picking up where we left off. I'm just going to drag it on for 30 seconds because I don't want to actually launch. I'm just going to give them a minute to come in. So a couple of the matters that we did talk about last week, we're going to be picking up on them. As I noted earlier, it's also an independent topic, so nothing to worry about. Hello, Eloise, and hello, Howard. Welcome back to JLI, and welcome to the Decision of Fate course. Whatever works for you. Okay, thank you. So with that, we're going to launch right into our case study, the first of two case studies that we're going to be engaging with tonight. The first one is a little bit of a longer one. Who's a brave reader? Nick, you want to take it?
Sure.
Okay, please join on page 46 in your student book, and we'll launch into case study A.
Okay, Francis Mao, David Goodall, Australian scientist, 104, ends life happy, BBC News, May of 2018. He perceived no other options, so 104-year-old scientist David Goodall left his home in Australia and flew across the world to end his life. The lauded ecologist and botanist did not suffer from a serious illness, but he wished to bring forward his death due to his diminishing independence. My abilities have been in decline for the past year or two. My eyesight over the past 6 years, Dr. Goodall told reporters in Switzerland where he had organized his death. I no longer want to continue life. I'm happy to have the chance tomorrow to end it. Dr. Goodall traveled to a clinic in the city of Basel to voluntarily end his life. He said he resented having to leave Australia to do so. The London-born academic had lived on his own in a small flat in Perth, Western Australia, until only a few weeks ago. He stepped back from full-time employment in 1979, but remained heavily involved in his work. In the last 30 years, Dr. Goodall edited a 30-volume series called Ecosystems of the World and was made a member of the Order of Australia for his scientific work. In 2016, aged 102, he won a battle to keep working on campus at Perth's Edith Cowan University, where he was an unpaid honorary research associate. He made his final trip out of Australia last week with his friend Carol O'Neill, a representative from assisted dying advocacy group Exit International. Mrs. O'Neill said the dispute in 2016 over Dr. Goodall's working space had affected him greatly. The row began when the university raised concerns about his safety, including his ability to commute. Although Dr. Goodall ultimately prevailed, he was forced to work in a location closer to home. It came at a time when he was also forced to give up driving and performing in theater, Mrs. O'Neill said. It was just the beginning of the end, she told the BBC. He didn't get to see the same colleagues and friends anymore at the old office. He just didn't have the same spirit, and he was packing up all his books. It was the beginning of not being happy anymore. Dr. Goodall's decision to end his life was hastened by a serious fall in his apartment last month. He was not found for 2 days. Later, doctors said he needed to engage 24-hour care or be moved into a nursing home. He is an independent man. He doesn't want people around him all the time, a stranger acting as a carer. He does not want that, Mrs. O'Neill said prior to the scientist's death. He wants to have intelligent conversation and still be able to do the same things like catching the bus into town. Switzerland has allowed assisted suicide since 1942. Other countries and jurisdictions have passed laws allowing people to voluntarily end their life. But many state terminal illness as a condition of eligibility. The Australian Medical Association remains strongly opposed to assisted dying, which it sees as an unethical practice of medicine. Doctors are not trained to kill people. It is deep within our ethics, deep within our training, that is not appropriate. That's not appropriate. President Dr. Michael Gannon said during last year's legislative debate in the state of Victoria. Now, not every doctor agrees with that, he added. Indeed, a survey of the AMA, Australia's most influential medical association, found 4 in 10 members supported the right to die policies. In his last days in Australia, the scientist revised his final letters and bade farewell to his extended family, including his many grandchildren. An online petition raised $20,000 for the scientist to fly in business class to Europe. He rested with family in France before heading to Switzerland with his closest relatives. His story gained attention locally at a time when his home state, Western Australia, is considering whether to debate assisted dying legislation. The state government had publicly expressed sympathy for Dr. Goodall, but said any proposed legislation would cover only terminally ill patients. Dr. Goodall said he would have preferred the chance to end his life in Australia. In his final appearances, he would often wear a jumper emblazoned with the words, "Aging disgracefully." I don't feel that anyone else's choice is involved. It is my own choice to end my life tomorrow, and I look forward to that, Dr. Goodall said. At my age, and even at rather less than my age, one wants to be free to choose death when the death is at the appropriate time, he told reporters. I certainly hope my story will increase the pressure for people to have a more liberal view on the subject.
Thank you. Appreciate that reading. So, on page 51, exercise 2.1. If you don't mind, would love some responses. Do you believe individuals like David Goodall should be free to choose to end their lives? What do you think? Yes or no? Any yeses?
Well, that's a very general question. I mean, well, like just, Dr. Goodall, what does that mean?
Just
like,
his story, yes or no? Okay,
what
one...
What's
that? Oh, so one yes.
Yes.
Two yeses. How many no's? Okay. Question number two. If you said no to that question, consider this. Had Dr. Goodall been suffering from a terminal illness, would you believe he should be free to choose to end his life?
Yes, if he's suffering.
May I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
A terminal illness that is going to result in his death shortly?
Great question. We kind of discussed it last week. Let's just use the definition of 12 months or less.
He has a terminal illness. He's 104. His chance of living to 105 is 50-50.
Well, but terminal illness 12 months means that that you're going to die because of the illness within 12 months. Doesn't mean that you're not going to live past 12 months. Okay.
I think it depends on pain and suffering, quality of life.
Okay, great point. We're going to be discussing that a lot. Let's go on to a much shorter case study B. Octavia, if you'd like to read that for us, please.
Yeah, make a comment about that story. The thing that really sticks out of that is that the patient was almost felt like he was abandoned by his colleagues, his institution that he was working for free, and even his family, which he said goodbye to, but no one was there. And there was that sense, aging disgracefully shows a sign of anger.
Did he not want anyone to come with him?
They were with him.
They traveled with him?
I think it said in there that his closest, didn't it say his closest?
Somebody came with him, but it seems like he said goodbye to most of his family for sure before he left.
Yeah,
well,
for sure.
If he had to raise money for his own trip, I don't know if his family was just going to have that one extra day to travel with him.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's a sad story. Okay.
Yeah, okay, let's go ahead with B. This is from rabbi, authoritative halachic rabbi who's writing.
An 11-year-old boy has been suffering for the past years from a cancerous growth in his brainstem. A significant accumulation of fluid was recently detected in his brain ventricles, and a ventricular peritoneal shunt was surgically inserted to drain the excess fluid. His physicians now seek to implant a different tube because the original tube has become blocked or infected. This procedure entails minimal risk, but it will prolong the boy's life and suffering. Is there an obligation to proceed with the surgery?
Okay. How would you be inclined to respond to the dilemma posed by case study B? Is there an obligation to proceed with the surgery? Anyone think yes? Yes? Anyone say no? Not if you should do it or not, but if you're obligated to do it or not.
Well, it doesn't say he's terminally ill.
I mean we described it, didn't use those words, but in other discussions it's clear that he is.
No, I don't just totally disagree with that. Well, it doesn't say that at all. It says if he's terminal ill, he's been living for 2 years with this stuff. And in this age group, it depends what it is.
Well, I think it was pretty clear that there was no reasonable thinking that he would heal from this.
What's the shunt for?
to buy time.
Palliation.
To get him some more time.
Yeah, that's how I read it. I think they're not obligated. I think this is palliation because there's no treatment for the tumor that's continued to grow and will be terminal. And
yeah.
No, it's implied because why wouldn't they?
It doesn't say any of that.
It says, but it will prolong the boy's life and suffering. So clearly, suffering will continue. It doesn't say terminally ill, but it's part of the story. So, if that is the case, then you say no obligation?
No, I think unless the parents don't sign the consent form. You do it.
Okay. Anybody else?
What about the suffering of the parents at the expense? You know, at what point do you consider that?
So it's a very good point. Both the financial component, suffering of the parents. I mean, first of all, in this case, obviously the parents have to make decisions. All that plays into the discussion we're going to have tonight. All right, so let's just note before we start analyzing the case studies a little bit more that there are two forms of medical suicide. There's euthanasia, which means that the doctor administers the lethal medication, and then there's what we call PAS, physician-assisted suicide. Over there, it's assisted, meaning they prescribe the drug, but they don't actually administer the drug. That the patient does on his own or her own. So these are the two possibilities. But pretty much what we're saying, we're not going to be, pretty much we're going to be referring to both of them throughout our discussion today. So let's go to the case studies that we just read. So as far as case study A, we're talking about an older person who was not suffering from any particular illness, but he was aging and he was losing his independence. That's pretty clear. And he wanted the freedom to end his life at his time of choosing. In case study B, different scenario. This is not about actively putting an end to someone's life. In this case, it's different. It's a moral dilemma about whether to perform a medical surgery that will extend the life of a terminally ill patient, or should you withhold it? In other words, case study A is a question about actively putting an end to a life. Case study B is about passively allowing a patient to die if you don't do the surgery. So, in case study A, the condition was old age, actively end life, and B, terminal illness, and the question is about passively allowing a patient to die. What both of these case studies have in common is that both of them present the question of what is going to be our priority. Is it going to be minimizing pain versus the value of life? So in both cases, in case study A, according to Mr. Goodall, he was suffering in his interpretation, which he's entitled to. So what do you prioritize, that or extending life? The same as with case study B. Obviously, there was suffering going on. This 11-year-old had a terminal illness. So are you obligated to do that surgery, which would extend life, or are you able to address the pain and suffering by not doing anything proactively, not to treat anymore, and just to passively allow the situation to unfold? That's the question. The common theme in both case studies, as different as they are. All good? Okay. So as far as secular law is concerned, U.S. law, which we're just going to touch upon so we can appreciate the difference a little bit, the right to die was addressed in a Supreme Court landmark decision in 1990 called the Cruzan decision. And as we have in figure 2.1, if you want, you can take a look at that on page 53. But in that Supreme Court decision, they ruled that patients have a constitutional right to refuse any form of medical treatment. And the court essentially said that every state could determine what's legal within that particular state. As of March of last year, there were 11 states where physician-assisted suicide is legal. Number of countries have also legalized it, as we saw before. So that's just a little bit of where U.S. law stands. Let's just take a look as far as secular law. Patients can refuse medical treatment. PAS for terminally ill patients is allowed in some places. Some countries place no restrictions on assisted suicide. Okay. So now let's see what Judaism has to say. What does the Torah have to say? So what we have to understand and appreciate is that secular law, American law, is all based on personal autonomy and liberty. That is the premise that secular law is built on. That every man is for himself, and I can make decisions. It's my life, my body, my decision. I could do as I please because it's mine. That is the premise. That's the foundation of secular law when it comes to anything related to one's life. However, Judaism has a very different approach. It's a very different value system. The value of autonomy and liberty is not the number one and beginning and end of everything. In Judaism, it's very different. We view life and we view the body not as mine to do what I want with, but rather it's something that we receive as a deposit from God Almighty. And this we did touch upon last week as well. When our soul enters a body, when we're born, this is God's way of giving us a body to look after. God is giving us a deposit. It doesn't become ours. It's ours to look after and take care of, but it remains in the domain of God. It's God's body, and it's given to us to take care of. If that's the case, then how do we take care of it? Well, think of if somebody asked you to take care of something, they're going on vacation and watch my car for 2 weeks or a month. They may give you some guidelines. And, of course, we're going to do our best to respect what they requested and their wishes of how we should take care of what's theirs. Similarly here, God gave us a value system, otherwise known as the Torah, and that's where we look to know how to take care of, well, how to live life in general, also how to take care of the body that God gave us to look after. So now, based on this foundation, that the body is not ours, it's God's, now the question is, how do we deal with end-of-life matters when it comes to treatments? Could treatments ever be withheld? What would be the Jewish way to view all of this? So, as I said before, it's obviously a very sensitive topic. We're going to try talking about it with compassion, with understanding, and we hope to be able to come to an understanding on at least to some degree. To get some information on what the Jewish approach to all this is. Okay, so we're going to first explore the perspective of Jewish law on the question of physician-assisted suicide, and then we'll move on to providing or withholding treatment. So basically the order of the case studies. So now let's take a dive into the Bible. So we have some verses up on the screen. They look familiar to anyone? Anyone know where they're from? Where in the Torah? What's that? Oh, it says already? Okay. Anyone know where what it comes after, what the context is? A little later. So it comes after the great flood. After Noah and the flood, God instructs Noah and his family about the severity of murder, and it comes with these verses in Genesis chapter 9. Len, would you like to read it for us, please, and then we'll dissect.
I will demand an accounting for your lifeblood from the hand of each human, from the hand of each person, for that of their brother. I will demand an accounting for a fellow human's life. Whoever sheds human blood shall have their blood shed by humans. For God made the human in his image.
Thank you very much. So let's analyze a little bit, and we'll get the help of the screen. So what are we learning here? Of course, this is a free translation of the words of the Bible, and let's understand. So, I will demand an accounting for your lifeblood. What does that mean? That is referring to prohibition against suicide. So that's the first thing. I will demand an accounting for your lifeblood. That means if somebody takes their own life, it's the first thing that's addressed. They are committing murder. In this case, not against somebody else, but against themselves. And as we said before, a person's life and body is not theirs to make such a decision. It is God's, and God tells us that it's a prohibition to do such a thing to one's life. Okay, that's the first few words of the verse. It continues, from the hand of each human, from the hand of each person, from that of their brother. What does that mean? Seems a little bit elaborate. What's the meaning here? So for the all three lines are referring their prohibition against homicide. You can't kill somebody else. But if that's the case, just say from the hand of each human. What does it mean from the hand of each person for that of their brother? So within homicide, there are two things being taught here. Number one, you have homicide, which is malicious murder. The first line, from the hand of each human, if one human murders another human, that is murder. But then you have another type of murder, and that is from the hand of each person for that of their brother. Now, why does it matter if somebody is a brother to someone and murders him, or if not. Does it matter if they're related or if they have no association altogether? So that's not what it means. It doesn't mean if you know the person or not. It's actually referring to two different types of homicide. The first is if it's coming out of hatred for the other, a malicious murder. The second line is referring to a mercy killing from the hand of each person for that of their brother. That is talking about a scenario where you are convinced that murdering somebody else is actually a brotherly act. It's an act of love. I'm doing it not out of hatred. I'm doing it to help them. I care for that person. That's why I'm doing it. As we use the term, a mercy killing. So let's actually read the commentator that explains this idea in text number 2. Lauren, would you like to read that for us, please?
There are two forms of murder. One is murder intended to be detrimental to the victim as an act of revenge or in order to take the victim's money or the life. The second form of murder is to benefit the other when someone is overwhelmed with tremendous pain and prefers death to life. The Torah addresses both scenarios. Regarding murder with detrimental intent, God warns us from the hand of each human. By contrast, the second form of murder, committed with the consent of the suffering individual and for their benefit, may even be perpetrated by a virtuous friend who may believe the act is a mitzvah. God therefore warns from the hand of each person for that of their brother.
Thank you. So this rabbi explains that the Torah prohibits both malicious murder and brotherly murder. By the way, euthanasia, what does the word mean in Greek? It means a good death. So it's designed to put an end to suffering, and you're doing it not out of anger, of course, but you're doing it from a place of concern and compassion. Yet the Torah brands that murder as well. So the question is, what comes next? The verse continues, and the verse tells us, why is it the case that this is also considered murder? Why, if somebody is killing someone out of love, why is that considered murder? For the same reason why any of the other ones are considered murder. I will demand an accounting for a fellow human's life. Whoever sheds human blood shall have their blood shed by humans. For God made the human in his image. Those are the key words, these final words. God made the human in his image. And because every single human being is created in the image of God, this is why killing any human being for any scenario, whether oneself, someone else, even for a good reason, is all considered murder. Because every single human is created in God's image, then it's God's domain only. Life and death is God's domain. It's not for us to tamper with it whatsoever. In fact, the Midrash explains to us and uses like this parable of a king who was coming to visit a city, and before he came, they minted coins in his image. They created statues with the king's image, placed them around the city. Now, if somebody goes and defaces one of these coins or one of these statues, are they just defacing some metal or some wood? Of course, they're defacing the image of whose image is on that statue. It's obviously the king. By the same token, when somebody murders another human being, it's not just that they're hurting somebody's body. It's the image of God that is engraved, that exists and is stamped, so to speak, on every human being. That is what's being defaced, and therefore all murder is murder, regardless of what the circumstances may be. And by the way, you may or may not be able to see it. I'm not going to ask you to turn all the way around, but on the cover of the Ark right there, you see there's like the two tablets are kind of, what's the word? Anyway, they're on the cover there, on the curtain. Embroidered is what I was looking for. So if you see the way they're the way they appear, it's five on one tablet and five on the next. Generally speaking, I'm not going to get into this in detail tonight. Generally speaking, the first five are between man and God commandments, and the second five, the left tablet, are between man and man commandments. But if you look at them, so you have five on one side, five on the other, the top two on the right side, the first one basically, is I am the Lord your God. But if you continue reading, not going down to the second commandment, but if you continue to the sixth commandment, what do you get? Do not murder. And that's not by coincidence. It's because these two are actually associated with each other. What is the reason why do not murder? Why do not murder? God forbid, if somebody does, it's an affront to the I am the Lord your God. That's what it emerges from. Because I am the Lord your God, that is why do not murder any human being. It's the image of God that is imprinted on every single human, and that is why murder is forbidden. And as we said, from the Jewish approach, in all circumstances, and as we note in text number 3, Helen, would you like to read that, please?
Is that page 60?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. A person in the throes of death is regarded as a living person in every respect. Though the patient is in terrible agony and they consider death preferable, we are nevertheless forbidden to do anything to hasten their death. The universe and all therein belongs to God, and this is His will.
Thank you. So this is true not just from somebody who's in the prime of their life and healthy and perfect. This is somebody who if you don't do a thing, they may die within 30 minutes. Doing anything to hasten their death is a violation of the image of God. It is considered murder from the perspective of Jewish law. Yes?
Is it considered to be inappropriate to try to ease suffering? From that perspective, I mean, if they're going to die in 30 minutes and you can make them more comfortable for that 30 minutes, is that acceptable?
Great question, and we'll deal with it.
Okay.
We'll deal with it soon. Let's just take a look at the screen based on what we know now. So we had secular law before, and now we just brought the Jewish law into the equation. And based on what we read from these verses in Genesis and these couple of commentaries, physician-assisted suicide is prohibited. Anything that will cause expedited death is prohibited. That's what we just read in text number 3. And now the question is, based on what we studied so far and established, is this the end all, or is there any, so to speak, room for discussion? It's clear that if somebody is on a ventilator, and we'll come back to this soon a little bit more, but just generally, if someone's on a ventilator, switching it off would be considered murder, not even a question. Where it becomes a problem is, do you have to put somebody on a ventilator in the first place? That is a different question. Switching it off is one question. If you have to put them on in the first place is another question. And we'll come back to that shortly. But first, we did establish that if somebody was going to be dying within hours or very soon, then doing anything to expedite that would be considered murder. So the question is, and this is not only true about the final hours, this may be true about the final days, weeks, or even months. And as we know from the news now and then, it may be years where a patient is maybe in a vegetative state and they have no awareness. Sure, the doctors in the room have a number of other terms for it, but the question is, why would we be going to that extreme when it comes to a situation where the person is naturally, there's nobody ever healed from this scenario, and you basically know what's happening. It's a matter of time. what is the reason? What value really is there? We say that someone who's minutes before dying is still considered alive and well for as far as the Jewish law perspective is, and killing someone like that, expediting somebody's death like that, is the same as doing it to somebody who's in the prime of their life. How can we gain an appreciation for this? Is there any value to that last phase in life, especially if somebody is not even aware of what's going on? So we're going to talk about this for a few minutes. We'll bring up a few points, 4 points specifically. Quite obvious that not all 4 points are going to apply to every single situation. Maybe one, maybe two, maybe all 4. But there's at least something of these that could be applied to every single life. But this will help give us some perspective on what we're dealing with. So actively terminating a life, it's not just a violation of something sacred, as we just said. Yes, God could say, every human is created in my image, and if you kill somebody, if you murder somebody, even somebody who is very sick, you violated the sanctity of their divine image. That's true. But now we're going beyond that. There's actually something productive about every single life, regardless of what age or stage they're in. And we'll go through a few things together. We'll start with text number 4. I'll read this one because it's a short one. This comes from a Mishnah recorded close to 2,000 years ago. First work of the oral tradition. And in this Mishnah, we read as follows. A single moment of repentance and good deeds in this world is greater than all the pleasures of the next world. Very powerful statement. One deed in this world, one positive deed, is greater than all the pleasures that we may experience in the next world. That means combined. And a single moment of bliss in the world to come is greater than all the pleasures of the present world. So, a good deed, a positive deed in this world is greater than everything we'll experience in the next world combined. A moment of bliss in the next world is greater than all the pleasures of this world combined. The most important point is that doing a positive deed here in this world is the greatest thing we can do, both in this lifetime and the next. There's something extremely powerful and potent about a mitzvah, about a positive deed. And as I said before, it could be a man in God mitzvah, it could be saying a prayer, it could be studying Torah as we're doing right now, it could be saying a blessing over a lulav, or a talis, or Shabbat candles, etc., or it could be a positive deed towards somebody else, being there for someone else, giving charity, anything like that is the most powerful thing a soul could ever do. Now, what if somebody is a patient in the hospital, extremely sick, and they're able to put a coin into a charity box? That fits the bill. That one deed is more powerful than anything they'll experience in the next world. If somebody comes into their hospital room and sounds the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, as rabbis do sometimes, they walk to hospitals after services and they share the mitzvah with many, many Jews who may be hospital bound. That mitzvah is the most powerful thing that soul can ever achieve, both in this world or the next. And that's true in any manifestation of a positive deed. So when this happens, this is something, and of course we have to reframe how we our priorities and how we look at life. But if we look at life by the opportunity to make a difference and live out who we are, then a positive deed is extremely powerful. It has eternal ramifications. In fact, Maimonides rules that one positive deed that one person does has the ability not just to tip their own scale over to the scale for merit in their own right, but they actually can do so for the entire world. Meaning every one deed that we do may be that one deed that the world was waiting for to earn its salvation. And that one deed could also be fulfilled by somebody who is hours away from their soul departing from this world. They can be the one to fulfill this one mitzvah. So that's actual productivity. Another point, in addition to good deeds, is what we say, what we call repentance. It's known that there is a custom among Jews, or maybe it's more than a custom, but there's a tradition that we try to recite some confessional prayers before a soul leaves this world, or the last opportunity when one is still conscious and able to. The point is that before leaving this world, you want to, so to speak, repentance literally is repenting for any mistake that we may have made during our lifetime. But the point here is, it's about the relationship between man and God. That's really what repentance is all about. When it comes to our relationship, whether it's a friendship, whether it's a marriage, or any relationship, you can't strengthen a relationship enough. Even two who share a deep relationship, you can deepen the relationship. And that's true about any. Most certainly between man and God. Regardless of how saintly this individual was throughout his or her lifetime, in the final stage of their life, they can deepen that relationship. And that could only be done here. Once you come to the next world, it's too late to actually tell a story about somebody, a fellow who was financially capable, but let's just say charity wasn't his strong point. Anyway, his soul returned to its maker, and he came up to heaven, and there was a fork in the road, and the angel brought this topic up, you know. I mean, you didn't really stand out in charity, although you were capable of it. And he takes out his checkbook on the spot and he starts writing out a check. The angel says, "I'm sorry, over here we only take receipts, no checks." At that point, it's too late. The difference can only be made in this world. So as long as a soul is here, they have the ability to make that difference. And that is invaluable. That's number two. Number three, even if we're talking about somebody who can't or will not or isn't capable anymore of making a difference in those first two items. They're not capable, maybe they're in a comatose stage or phase, and they're not capable of it. So what's the value then? What's the productive value of them remaining alive? So for item number three, it's the light of the soul. As long as a soul exists here in this world. So when we're born, actually, it's kind of what the next text is telling us. When we're born, our soul begins to be revealed within our body and through our body into the world. But that's only the beginning of our soul coming in contact with its mission here in the world and making a difference. It actually unfolds throughout our entire lifetime. And in fact, the more time that we're here, the longer the soul is here in this world, the greater its impact, the more its light shines, and the more its light is unleashed and its energy is unleashed into the world. The longer it's here, the more that happens. Regardless, even if they're retired or less productive as they get older, as far as the soul is concerned, the more time that it's here, the more it is having an impact on the world. Regardless, doesn't have to be through a deed per se. Just the fact that it's here means that it's having an impact. Now, if every person, as we said before, is created in the image of God and brings divine energy into the world, when somebody passes away and their divine image is no longer here, so in a sense, God's presence is diminished from the world by every individual passing away. I'm going to go off topic. Well, it's on topic, but off, digress a little bit. Everyone knows that we recite Kaddish after somebody passes away. And famously, if you open up the Kaddish and read the translation, you're not going to find the word death in there. You're not going to find the word mourning in there. You're not going to find anything related to loss or anything like that. And everyone asks, why are we reading this? Why do we say it for somebody after they pass away? And the answer is that the opening words of Kaddish, Yitkadal, V'yitkadash Shmei Rabba, what does that mean? It means that God's name, Shmei Rabba, means God's great name. Yitkadal means it should be It should be magnified. V'yitzkadash, it should be sanctified. Why are we saying this after a death? That's because when somebody leaves this world, God's presence was diminished here in this world. But that person now missing and not here, God's energy was diminished from the world with their passing. Now we have to restore, so to speak, God's presence in the world. We achieve that by reciting Kaddish, by saying that God's name should be magnified and should be sanctified. We're restoring the presence of God in the world to the place that it was before that person left the world. Point being, we spoke about the power of the soul. The longer somebody is alive here in this world, the greater their soulful impact. That's number three. And number four, a very important component is that a person has the ability to inspire others. And for that, they don't even need to be consciously aware. Just by somebody being present, even if they are in a coma. But the fact that other humans, the fact that their loved ones, their family members, are expressing love to them and taking care of them, that may be part of his or her mission of the person who is ill, who is not even capable of communicating. Part of their mission may be to teach other people how to express their love to them, or to anyone for that matter, but to actualize the potential of loved ones to bring out their ability to express their love and ability to take care of somebody in that state. That is something that's being achieved by the individual who is in that comatose state. And essentially, they are inspiring others to do good in a very clear and direct way specifically as a result of the situation they're in right now. Maybe something they couldn't have even done earlier in life. So this is really four powerful ideas that we can think about where a person, even in a last phase of life, even if they're not aware of what's going on, they still could make a difference and a productive difference. And therefore, when it comes to talking about the fact that murder is prohibited in Jewish values, it's not just because we're violating the sanctity of God in them. It's we're actually robbing them of the opportunity to be productive here in this world in any of these particular ways. So, the Jewish approach, Jewish ethics take a... Where are we? Jewish ethics take a responsibility-based approach to life's dilemmas. So, it's a very different worldview, let's just say. It's a different value system. As opposed to what we said before, the secular view being that it's my life and I could do whatever I want with it. The Jewish view is that it's owned by God, given to us to take care of, and therefore every human being created in the image of God, we can't violate that under any circumstances, and therefore, just to close this idea, there's three ways basically how we could relate to somebody in a situation like this, or three reasons why we would not do anything to shorten somebody's life. We can say emotionally we shouldn't do so because let me say it like this. There's three reasons why we say we shouldn't do it. If there's an emotional reason, because emotionally, if you see somebody or a loved one suffering, then you feel like you want to do something to help them. What could I do to help them and to alleviate their suffering? By legalizing PAS, as we said before. Then there's an intellectual approach that I may take against legalizing physician-assisted suicide. And that is, in other words, there are people who are very anti-legalizing it, and has nothing to do, it's totally from a secular perspective. And in their view, it's basically if you allow it, then you're going to end up doing things that should never be allowed. So you're tampering with an area that's too sensitive, and you don't want to go there, so just stay away from it totally. But that's arguing that it's not intrinsically wrong. They're okay with it. It's just that it's a slippery slope, and you don't know what's going to come next. But both of these approaches are both problematic. The Jewish approach is that it's a much more transcendent approach. And as we said, acknowledging that God alone has the right to tamper with the sanctity of life and of the divine image, and every person has a mission while they're here in this world, and it's not anyone's right to interfere with that. Any quick question or comment? We're good. So we're just going to close out this section with a short video. This video is actually of a colleague. His name is Rabbi Yitzi Horowitz. He was the director of Chabad in Temecula, California. But that's until he was diagnosed with ALS, which is probably close to 10 years ago already. And the fact that he's still alive, actually, as we speak, is miraculous. I think he's like a father of eight. Very sad story, but we're going to learn a very powerful lesson from this Rabbi Horowitz. Anyone who's familiar with ALS, he basically has been bedridden and not able to do anything. The only thing he is able to do is he still continues to write articles on Torah and Judaism with his eyes until this very day. Let's take a look.
I was talented. I could teach, lecture, sing, dance, and play guitar. I was strong and handy. Within 2 years, I watched all that slip away. I felt irrelevant. I was in jail. What possible purpose could I have if I couldn't communicate? It hurts not to be able to kiss and hug my children, not to be able to talk and play with them. I could have been prey to a why me attitude and fallen into depression. The problem with why me is that your focus is on me, the ultimate false deity. Instead, knowing that this is from Hashem makes me think, how could I serve his purpose from my situation? What can be done from my position now that could not be accomplished when I was well? Do I pray? Do I cry out to Hashem that he heal me? Yes, all the time. However, the illness has not broken my spirit. I continue using my difficulties as a platform to lift others up. What keeps me going is the realization that God is real, that he has a plan for the world and I am part of it. Everyone is a part of it and everyone's part is important. So if he put me in this position, he must want something of me that I can only do in this position. When you see it this way, instead of feeling down when you are in a challenging situation, you are filled with a sense of purpose. I choose to focus on the positive parts of my life, and that keeps me going. There is my wife, my children, family, friends, and you. Even within the suffering and difficulties, I can still contribute and help others. Through my blog, I have the opportunity to learn and teach Torah. I forge new friendships with the teens and yeshiva boys that visit. Find your mission and strength specifically from your situation. You don't have to be challenged with suffering to learn this lesson. You need only be alive, because it is Hashem that chooses for you to be alive. Recognizing this is the beginning of meaning in your life. If you are suffering, know that there is purpose in your struggle that can only be realized through your struggle. Find a way to turn your pain into positive, your struggle into strength. There is something else being asked of you, a new stage of your purpose and mission. True, I can't do many of the things I once could, but with what I do have, I have found ways to make a difference. The things I love to do most, to teach and lift others up, I'm still doing. Before, I would speak. Now, I write. It seems that because of my predicament, the words are more effective. In every challenge, or even tragedy, there is an opportunity. You don't have to fight it. Find a way for your struggle to take you to the next level. By taking this attitude, I was filled with a mission to uplift as many as I can through my articles. And my wife Dina became one of the most inspirational speakers and has uplifted tens of thousands. It doesn't fix the problem, but it makes our lives more meaningful and therefore more bearable. Being crushed brought stronger connections, new abilities, higher purpose, and deeper meaning. I've been blessed with a voice that can't sing, with a body that doesn't work. So I dance to a new rhythm. I'm Yitzi Hurwitz, and I know that I matter.
So, very powerful, but I think this speaks for itself more than anything I said for the last 10 minutes on the meaning that that one can find in life. And as we all know, pain without meaning is really painful. But when pain comes with meaning, then it's bearable. So similarly here, when we when somebody is experiencing pain, obviously it's easy for me to stand here and say it, but it's all a question of, is there meaning in it or not? So if we're able to look deeper, like Yitzi is, and see a person's life as having meaning beyond just on the surface, then perhaps we can uncover new layers of purpose as well. Okay, with that, we're going to kind of transition. Any comments? We're good? All right. So we're going to launch into the next section, which is going to take up most of the remaining time. And that is, based on what we studied so far, one might be inclined to say that Jewish law will instruct to continue with all types of medications and treatments, anything available, anything possible to extend one's life. Everything we just said is that doing different, expediting somebody's death under any circumstance is considered murder. If that's the case, we would think that we need to do the exact opposite and extend life in any circumstance. The question is that the case, and is this true? So to answer this question, we're going to take a look at two very important texts, one from the Talmud and one from Maimonides, which is basically Jewish law, and we will try to analyze them and get a better understanding of the more nuanced approach to all of this. So, we're holding at text number 7. I think we're at Howard, is that correct?
Yep.
If it's okay with you, on page 66, if you can please read this, everyone should read this text carefully because we're going to be relying on it a lot.
This is what occurred on the day that Rabbi, you're going to have to help me with that.
Yehuda
Ahasi died. The sages proclaimed a fast and they supplicated for divine mercy so that he would not depart from the world. Rabbi Yehuda went up to the attic and prayed. The angels on high asked for Rabbi Yehuda to ascend, and the people below asked for Rabbi Yehuda to remain. May it be your will that those below prevail over those above. Later, however, when she saw that he was in great pain, she prayed, may it be your will that those who prevail over those below, will that those above prevail over those below. The sages, however, would not cease praying, which prevented the heavens from gathering his soul. So she grabbed a jug and threw it from the attic to the ground. Stunned by the noise, the sages stopped their prayers momentarily and in that intervening moment, Rabbi Yehuda's soul departed.
Okay, very important text. We'll come back to it shortly. Eloise, text number 8 from Maimonides, please.
Shabbat laws are suspended in the face of danger to life, as are all other mitzvot. We follow the direction of a professional physician on hand and attend to all of the patient's needs on Shabbat. If the structure collapses on Shabbat, the rubble must be cleared if there is even a doubt as to whether a person is beneath the debris, although clearing rubble is otherwise forbidden on Shabbat. If a person is discovered alive, even if they are injured and crushed to the extent that it is impossible for them to recover, we must continue clearing the debris to extricate them in the interest of preserving life for a short time.
Thank you. So we actually had the second part of this text last week as well, but we have two texts here. We have 7 and 8. Let's take a look. Text number 7, which was the story of the passing of Rabbi Yehuda. By the way, he was the author of the Mishnah. And the day he was passing away, the sages were praying that he stays, that he gets better. And initially, the rabbi's maid was also praying that he should get better. But then she saw how, to what degree of pain he was in, and she changed her prayer. Now she started praying that his time should come and he should be able to be let go. But the sages didn't change. They continued to pray for his healing. So nothing was changing. And as we read, she dropped or threw a jug down on the floor, and which shocked them. And in that pause from their prayers, Rabbi Yehuda had passed away. So what does that tell you? That could tell you, and by the way, the maid, from other sources in the Talmud, we know that she was a very learned woman and very attuned to Jewish law as well. And that's why we're able to extract laws from the story. So text number 7 may be telling us that withholding treatment is permitted if the patient is terminally ill and suffering. So what did she do? And as we said, she was an authority to some degree. She did something that would make them stop praying, and in that moment, he would pass away. In text number 8, what do we have from Maimonides? That you must fight for every moment of life, no matter what the prognosis is. What did we just say? That if somebody is trapped under rubble on Shabbat, you know that they're crushed, you know that he's suffering, you know that even if you extricate him, he's just going to be alive for a little while, or whatever, but he's deeply in trouble. You still violate Shabbat, even if it's just a matter of him having another few hours of life. So this seems to be telling you that you extend life at all costs. So we have two different messages here. And now the question is, which is the primary approach? Do we allow death, like text number 7, or do we fight for life, like text number 8? Which is primary? Everything good? Okay. So, as we did last week, we're going to bring up a couple of authorities, world-renowned authorities of the last generation on Jewish medical ethics. The first one is going to be Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who we also quoted last week. He actually passed away in 2006. He served as a judge on the Supreme Rabbinical Court in Jerusalem, etc. And when it comes to a scenario like this, and in fact, this was the rabbi who we already quoted in case study B about the boy, the 11-year-old boy who was in trouble. And the question was if he should undergo a surgery to extend his life or not. So this was the rabbi that got the question. And his answer is going to be on one end of the spectrum. Let's see number 9. Nick, sure. If you're okay with that, please.
Jewish law asserts that we violate the laws of Shabbat even for the sake of one who is severely injured and can only live a little while longer. When we extricate this person, we inevitably prolong their suffering. Nevertheless, we are obligated to make every effort to prolong their life. If this is so on Shabbat, certainly on a weekday, we are obligated to make every effort to prolong life, even for a brief duration, and even if this entails additional suffering.
Thank you. So Rabbi Waldenberg will say in case study B that we studied before, he will say that this boy should undergo the surgery because he focuses largely on text number 8 of these two, and he says that you fight for life regardless of what the prognosis is. Doesn't matter what's going on. If you have an opportunity to extend life even for a little bit, that's what takes priority in his view. And that's why, based on this law of extricating somebody from the rubble, even for a matter of hours to live after that, you still do it and you violate Shabbat because nothing is above extending life. But what would he say about the story of Rabbi Yehuda's passing? If you would ask Rabbi Waldenberg, how are you ignoring that story? Well, he'll say that learned as the maid was, she was just one individual. In Jewish law, we follow the majority, and the sages, who were a group of people versus her who was an individual, we always follow the majority. If there's one person who says differently, we follow the majority. If that's the case, he'll say that the sages continued to pray. Even though they likely knew that he was in pain, they still felt that they should do whatever they can to extend his life. Now, the question is, let's say the surgery that the 11-year-old boy would have, in that case was a shunt, but whatever scenario it would be, if the surgery that was on the table, the suggested surgery, is not a very promising one. And we discussed this last week as well. So if the chances of it succeeding are less than 50%, then even Rabbi Waldenberg will say that you don't have to do the surgery. Only if we know that the surgery is generally successful, certainly in the majority of cases, then he would say to do it so that you can extend life above all else. Okay. Now let's go to another authority who we also discussed last week. We mentioned him, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. He passed away in 1986. He was stationed in the Lower East Side of Manhattan his entire life and was considered a great halachic authority of the last generation and relied upon by today's rabbis heavily. So let's see 10a, how he would go about interpreting these texts that we read.
If physicians can neither cure a patient nor ease their suffering, they should not administer treatments that only serve to prolong briefly the terminal patient's life and suffering. We infer this from the Talmud's description of Rabbi Yehuda's final illness. The sage's prayers did not produce a cure for Rabbi Yehuda or lessen his agony, but only prolonged his ordeal for as long as they continued to pray. Rabbi Yehuda's maid, who was knowledgeable in the Torah, said, "May it be your will that those above prevail over those below." Upon seeing that her prayers could not be effective as long as the sages continued their supplications, she took a jug and smashed it in order to silence them. At that moment, Rabbi Yehuda passed away. The incident is cited in the Talmud to teach us that the maid acted correctly. We can derive from this that a physician should not administer to a patient a treatment that will neither cure them nor alleviate their torment, but will serve only to prolong their life for a short duration in agony. The physician should only administer such treatment if it will soothe the patient.
Thank you very much. So there's clearly, in Rabbi Feinstein's view, there's a moral difference in between actively taking action to end somebody's life versus passively allowing it to happen. In his view, there's a clear difference. As far as the story of the maid in Rabbi Yehuda's passing, he'll say that that she did the right thing, because you don't have to extend life and do something. You don't have to continuously do something proactively to extend life. So as long as what you do, whatever that intervention would be, if it's going to be short-lived and we know that he's still going to be in immense pain, then it's not necessary to administer whatever that is. So this is Rabbi Feinstein as far as those teachings are concerned. Let's go on to 10b, continuing Rabbi Feinstein, please. Octavia.
In my response to the physicians, I wrote that one should administer oxygen to a terminally ill patient who has trouble breathing, even though no cure will result, because it eases the patient's suffering, for inability to breathe is tremendously painful. Accordingly, you asked regarding a terminally ill patient who is unable to eat normally, should we intravenously feed him and thus extend his life while prolonging his suffering when it appears that he has no pain and abstaining from food? My response, clearly we must feed the patient, provided it will not cause any harm, for food surely strengthens the patient somewhat, despite the possibility that neither the patient nor his attendants are aware of this effect. There is no need, however, to provide medicine with the assumption that it too will strengthen the patient. And the distinction is obvious. Eating is a natural need that is required to strengthen one's body and mind.
Thank you. So Rabbi Feinstein is making a distinction here in between oxygen, food, and general medication that aren't painful to administer. They don't come with a procedure or similar, versus other treatments that come with additional pain. If you're going to intubate or a variety of other things that you're actually going to bring pain with it, he makes a distinction between those two, and he says that the hydration, nutrition, oxygen must be provided, even though he sees room to not need to provide other things that are going to bring about more pain. So Rabbi Feinstein would disagree with that Supreme Court decision. First, he never allows withholding a feeding tube unless the actual feeding tube will bring more pain on the patient. But as long as it won't, he's never okay with not feeding. And second, all medications must be administered, even if someone is in a vegetative state, unless we know that A, they're terminally ill, and that it is extremely painful. Then he would consider a scenario of withholding medications. So as far as case study B, with the 11-year-old boy, what would Rabbi Feinstein say? We know what Rabbi Waldenberg said. What would Rabbi Feinstein say? He probably would say that the procedure does not need to be performed. There's no obligation to do so if the boy was terminally ill and he was suffering, which seems to have been the case. So he would be okay with it not being done. So we have two sides of the spectrum here. We have Waldenberg and Feinstein on two ends. The question is there a middle ground? So the answer is yes. And we also quoted this third rabbi last week, and his name is Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And he too was a leading authority on Jewish law and medical ethics. And his teachings, at least in this case, is recorded by a student of his who's alive and well. And that's in text 11. Len, if I can ask you, please.
There is a difference between treatments that satisfy the natural needs of a patient, or those considered ordinary treatments, and those that are considered extraordinary treatments. For example, if the patient suffers from metastasized cancer and is about to die, although they are in pain, we may not withhold the required oxygen, nutrition, and hydration. If they suffer from diabetes, we may not withhold insulin with the intention that they die sooner. Blood transfusions and any other medication that a patient requires, such as antibiotics, should not be withheld. On the other hand, there is no obligation to initiate an extraordinary medical procedure, that is, a procedure that would itself cause much pain, in addition to the pain that this patient already experiences. This treatment has no chance of curing the underlying disease, but only extending the life for a short duration.
Thank you. So what Rabbi Orbach tries to do here is accommodate these two conflicting values. So on the one hand, as we said, life at all costs. On the other hand, what can we do to avoid pain and suffering? So he tries to accommodate both the story of Rabbi Yehuda's passing versus the ruling of Maimonides, by stating that certain treatments must be provided to extend life, while other treatments are able to be withheld, calling them ordinary versus extraordinary. So let's just say if somebody was a terminally ill cancer patient or stroke patient, and they contract pneumonia. When it comes to antibiotics, those need to be administered.
Because I have to just jump in here. That's not reality.
What?
Right there, that's not reality. That's exactly how people exit.
You're saying if somebody could be a cancer patient, mm-hmm. and then they can contract pneumonia,
mm-hmm.
okay, and what do you do then?
Nothing.
But what if they are treated with
if they have truly metastatic lethal cancer and they contract an infection, that's usually the way they go out.
So the question is, what if you gave them antibiotics?
What are you doing?
Could they live another few weeks? That's not what I'm asking. We know that there's secular law and Jewish values.
I'm telling you what reality is.
The reality of outside of Jewish values.
Yeah, hospitals.
Okay. Granted.
Not shuls.
Okay. So the question is, if that patient would be somebody who wants to end their life according to Jewish values. So this is exactly, this is the aha moment. Thank you for providing it.
Okay,
sure. But if the patient or the family wished the antibiotic to be given,
if the family wants it done,
the physicians wouldn't have no choice.
The family wants it, if the family says, you come to the family, patient has pneumonia, in the hospital, dying, up before that, forget about the pneumonia. Cancer's out of control, untreatable, or it's been treated multiple times unsuccessfully, and they contract an infection.
So this is exactly the question. So Rabbi Orbach, who's accommodating both sides here, would say that that medications that don't bring on more pain should not be withheld. But do you have to start another round of chemo, which brings with it a whole host of other issues that he would say is not necessary?
That's for sure true.
Not according to Waldenberg, by the way. Some will say that anything you can do to get another week or whatever out of life, they'll take that approach. The majority follow Orbach, who is the middle ground.
Blood transfusion and antibiotics are often not administered.
Okay, yes, Helen.
So, my husband died of cancer. And we went to MD Anderson. They tried an experimental treatment. It wasn't working. And so, we decided to stop because it wasn't going to help. The treatment definitely caused him more pain and discomfort. And so we decided, the two of us, to say, enough is enough. The time will come. We're not going to speed it up, but we're not going to do anything that we know isn't going to work just to say, well, maybe we gain a day at terrible discomfort to him. So we said, no. And I think that's part of the reality, too. If it had been something that was going to help, we might have looked at it a little bit differently, but we had been told by people who knew more than we did that this isn't helping, the cancer is continuing to grow, it's not going to help him anymore. So you can look at it from many different ways. Number one, if he stays in that protocol, maybe he gets a drug that could have helped somebody else that wasn't going to help him. So is that the right thing to do? And We had some long discussions about this. It was not an easy decision to make. But
have to feel like we made the right choice.
First of all, I'm very sorry for what you experienced. But everything you're saying sounds like you followed what Rabbi Orbach would recommend.
It's not what Rabbi Orbach would.
Well, we talked about medications, trying new medications that they know wouldn't have worked. He would say it's not necessary to do so.
If I can ask, if it isn't too painful, did anybody offer
he didn't have an infection.
But it's pretty common that that's the case.
We had talked to the oncologist at the beginning. We said, look, we know it's terminal. We believe in hospice. Let's go in. And that was her only job, is to tell us when. And when he went into the hospital for the last time, she turned to me and she said, it's time. And so that's what we did. But we knew that going in. It wasn't like when we tried and we thought it was going to make a big difference. We knew. I mean, at the time he was diagnosed, it was already stage 4. So we were just buying time. And we did that. And I'm grateful for the time that we had. But I have to believe that we made the right choice.
I'm absolutely certain you did.
Yeah, for sure. Because my grandmother suffered greatly with treatment that absolutely did not extend her life whatsoever. I mean, they just burned her up.
I mean, it lasted a couple of years. I mean,
that's a long
time. We had
some
time that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And
it sounds like you did everything that you were supposed to.
If it had just been me, if you weren't part of the equation, I would have just said, let's not treat it, never mind. Let's just not bother.
Yeah.
But it bought me more time with you.
There you go.
And that was important. But we knew that the time was going to be limited.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's it. Right there.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And as I said, it sounds like you did everything that was supposed to be done in that scenario for certain. And these are real life issues. These are not just academic discussions that we're having here. And that's really the purpose of these conversations, so that we are grounded in Jewish values and that we know how to deal with, all of us are confronted by situations in one day or another. I don't know if I mentioned last week, I lost my father to cancer 4 years ago, and at Columbia Hospital in New York, we had these same conversations with the doctors, so... It's very relevant and very real and painful, and we can do only the best that we can based on the values that were time-tested values of Judaism of 3,300 years. So we'll kind of just summarize. Actually, it's not on the screen. It's in, well, maybe it is. Yeah, let's just take a quick look here, and we'll kind of summarize these three different authorities, and then we'll close with one final idea. So the question was if treatment could be withheld. Rabbi Waldenberg, that was the first one we mentioned, said that not, and he said that this does not apply to risky treatments, meaning if something is a very small chance of it working, then even he would agree that it's not necessary. It's not certainly not obligated. Rabbi Feinstein would say that treatment can be withheld, and with the exception of essentials that need to be continued to be provided. And Rabbi Orbach, as we said, terminally ill patients can decline treatment that causes them severe pain, and at the same time, family or doctors could try to encourage them to accept life-extending treatment, but as we said, it's certainly not the obligation. So, just with the final few minutes, let's just take a look and see, based on what we learned, when is a DNR appropriate? When is a DNI appropriate? And are living wills acceptable according to Jewish law? So first of all, it's very important, and I noted this last week as well, and we'll see in a second, how it's really important to have an expert rabbi consulted when it comes to these very serious decisions. And when I say expert rabbi, I don't even mean myself. In other words, I'm happy to serve as, and I do, serve as a liaison to the expert rabbi for many families that I'm in contact with here, and they'll reach out to me because that's who they know. But I will still take the case to a world-renowned expert, kind of like the ones we're quoting here, because every single case is so different, and there's so many nuances and so many sensitivities based on who and what and when. So it's very important to have an open channel to a rabbi that will give you authoritative information of Jewish values. So one important area that none of the authorities disagree on is that age and mental awareness and physical ability, they generally play no role when it comes to end-of-life decisions. In other words, there isn't really a difference here. Let's just say a 90-year-old person who has been in good health, and this 90-year-old suffers from cardiac arrest. What is the attitude supposed to be? The fact that they're 90 years old means absolutely nothing from the perspective of Jewish law. As long as they were healthy and they could be resuscitated and whatever treatments could bring them back and they can do well afterwards, then we do that. The fact that their age makes no difference. On the other hand, it could be somebody younger, but if they're in a difficult situation, as we said, and they're terminally ill and there's pain involved and suffering, then, as we said, there's even certain things that are painful that we don't even need to do. Like not intubating in the first place. It's not required to do so if the person is in a state, it is terminally ill, and doing so will just prolong their suffering. So, in fact, someone just told me this week, a local guy, he said his mother-in-law is 94 years old and she's taking chemotherapy because in her state, at her stage, it could work, and that's what should be done. The point is that the age is not the defining factor, it's the situation, the individual situation that is the defining factor. And that's what that's where attention should always be paid to. So point is that just from the Jewish perspective, a DNR or a DNI is not a very good idea, because when somebody has it, then things are done that may not be applicable in their particular situation. But when you have it, certain protocols are followed, and you guys could tell me more than I'll ever know. And therefore, the perfect thing may not be done according to Jewish values if you just have a DNR, and that's what's followed blindly. So it's not the best scenario if somebody wants Jewish values to determine every step. A much better approach is what we call a healthcare proxy, and there's actually some examples of it here at the end of the lesson. And in that case, when you appoint somebody who you know is not going to make decisions without the information and the guidance of a competent expert rabbi, then you're in a much better place to know that the right thing will be done. I just want to close with this final idea, and that is that there was a Turkish rabbi, Rabbi Chaim Palagi, and he was asked about a case in which a woman was suffering for many years from a terrible illness, and asked her family to pray that she should die, kind of like we had before, but just the other way around. I mean, the maid. So the question came to this rabbi, this Turkish rabbi, and from her family, asking if they're allowed to pray that their mother or loved one should die. And the rabbi answered them, actually pointing to the story of the rabbi's maid that we read and discussed before. pointing to this story, this Rabbi Palagi ruled that it should normally be permissible, but he added something really important. He asserted that only disinterested parties should be the ones praying for your mother's death. It shouldn't be the people taking care of her, and it shouldn't be her loved ones. Why is that? Because the people taking care of her, they may be exhausted from the work, and they may have some ulterior motive in wanting to expedite her death. So they wouldn't be doing it only for her sake. You need somebody praying for her to pass away that is doing so 100% for her sake, for her benefit. But if it's for the sake of the caretakers, and they're having in mind that they wouldn't mind some relief, or the loved ones who are very emotionally tied in to the suffering of their loved one, if they're going to be the ones praying, then they may do so with ulterior motives. They have their own agenda, and it's not purely for the sake of the patient. This is why this rabbi ruled that while there may be room for it, it should not be them, it should be other people. So with that, we close this very loaded discussion. And I think the most important thing we take out of this is, of course, we spoke a lot about the end of life, but I think this informs very much not just end of life, but life itself, and what kind of values need to inspire our day-to-day life when everything is good and well. And if we live daily with Jewish values as the foundation of our thought process and of our perspectives and our worldview, then we're living with purpose. We're living in a mission-oriented way, and then when we encounter an obstacle or a health-related matter, then we're equipped with tools of how to deal with it in a much different way, and hopefully a way that can have some measure of purpose, as we heard so inspiringly before from Rabbi Horowitz suffering from ALS. So with this, we'll turn to our closing video. This we all discussed. Knowing that we have a mission to accomplish allows us to move forward despite hardships.
Extending life. 1. Each human is created in the image of God.